Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're navigating a really significant corner of legal history, a case called Porter v. Johnson from 1938. Now, this might not be as immediately recognizable as, say, Shelley v. Kramer, but it provides absolutely vital context for understanding the legal battles around racial segregation in housing before that more famous Supreme Court decision.
Exactly. Think of Porter v. Johnson as a crucial snapshot of the legal mindset at the time. Our goal today is to really dissect this case, understand the court's reasoning, and see how the legal system was grappling, or perhaps more accurately, failing to grapple effectively with deeply discriminatory practices before Shelley came along in 1948 and declared state enforcement of these covenants unconstitutional.
Right. It's tempting to look back and just condemn these racial covenants, which, well, we absolutely should. But to truly understand the journey towards fair housing, we need to get into the nitty-gritty of cases like Porter. We need to see how the courts justified upholding these discriminatory agreements. So let's start with the basics. What exactly were the circumstances of this case?
Okay, let's unpack the story. It all unfolds in Kansas City, Missouri. Back in 1921, a group of white property owners on Tracy Avenue decided to create a private agreement amongst themselves. This wasn't, you know, a law passed by the city or the state, but a contract between neighbors.
A private contract?
Yes. This contract, known as a restrictive covenant, explicitly stated that for the next 30 years, none of these property owners would sell, lease, or in any way transfer their property to African Americans. Imagine your neighbors getting together to sign a document specifically designed to exclude an entire group of people based solely on their race. That's the reality of this 1921 covenant.
So a legally formalized attempt at racial exclusion at the neighborhood level through a private contract. Then, 14 years later, in 1935, Carl and Carrie Johnson, a black couple, purchased a home on Tracy Avenue. Crucially, they reportedly knew about this existing covenant when they bought the property at 2602 Tracy Avenue.
That's right. And predictably, the original property owners who had signed that 1921 agreement were not happy. They filed a lawsuit seeking to enforce this restrictive covenant. They wanted the court to issue an injunction, a court order, that would essentially force the Johnsons to move out and legally invalidate their purchase.
So the weight of the legal system was being asked to actively dismantle this black family's attempt to establish a home. What happened at the initial trial court level? Was there any glimmer of hope for the Johnsons there?
There was, actually. A moment of potential relief. The trial court actually ruled in favor of the Johnsons, refusing to grant the injunction. The judge essentially said, we're not going to force this family to leave based on this agreement.
Okay, so a win initially.
Initially, yes. However, the story doesn't end there. The original property owners, determined to uphold their racially exclusive agreement, appealed the decision to the Kansas City Court of Appeals. And this is where we see a significant shift in the legal landscape of this case.
Because the appellate court flipped the script entirely. They reversed the trial court's decision and actually ruled in favor of enforcing the restrictive covenant. This seems like a real turning point, highlighting the prevailing legal winds at the time. What was the core justification for this reversal?
You've nailed it. The appellate court's decision really underscores the legal priorities of that era. They placed a very strong emphasis on what they called the sanctity of contracts. Their perspective was that this covenant was a valid agreement freely entered into by property owners, and unless there was an overwhelming legal reason to invalidate it, the court's role was to uphold it. So what we're seeing here isn't just an old legal case. It's a stark illustration of how legal systems can actively construct and maintain racial inequality. That prioritization of contract over basic human dignity has echoes even today in ongoing debates about housing and systemic injustice.
So the big legal question at the heart of this case becomes, were these explicitly racist agreements legally enforceable in the eyes of the court at this time? And what legal arguments could someone like the Johnsons realistically bring to bear against such a discriminatory covenant?
Precisely. The central legal issue was indeed the enforceability of a racially discriminatory covenant through the power of the state. Could a private agreement that explicitly barred people from owning property based on their race be legally enforced by the courts? Alongside this, the Johnsons' legal team raised an argument based on the changed conditions doctrine.
The changed conditions doctrine, okay, this sounds like a crucial concept here. Can you break down what that means in this context?
Absolutely. Essentially, the Johnsons argued that the character of the neighborhood had changed so significantly since the covenant was put in place in 1921 that it would be unfair and no longer serve its original purpose to enforce it in 1935.
So basically trying to say times have changed, the restriction is outdated.
Kind of, yes. Their argument was that the area around Tracy Avenue had seen an increase in black residents, and they contended that this shift in demographics made the original intent of the covenant to maintain a white-only enclave obsolete or no longer equitable. You have to remember, the law generally respects private agreements, so courts were hesitant to overturn them unless there was a very compelling reason.
Right.
This three-part test reflects that reluctance and places a significant hurdle on those trying to escape the terms of a contract, even one as morally reprehensible as this.
So the Johnsons were essentially saying, look, the neighborhood isn't what it was when this agreement was signed. It's becoming a more diverse area, so this old restriction shouldn't apply anymore. That seems like a reasonable argument from a fairness perspective. How did the court actually analyze this changed conditions claim?
This is where the appellate court's reasoning gets really specific and, frankly, quite telling. They didn't just dismiss the idea of changed conditions. They laid out a very specific three-part test that the defendants, the Johnsons, had to meet to successfully argue that the covenant should no longer be enforced due to these changes.
Okay, and what exactly were those three hurdles that the Johnsons had to clear?
First, the court said the Johnsons needed to demonstrate that there had been radical changes within the specific restricted area defined by the 1921 covenant itself, not just in the surrounding neighborhoods.
Within the lines, essentially.
Exactly. Second, they had to prove that enforcing the covenant would cause undue hardship, specifically on Carl and Carrie Johnson. And third, they needed to show that enforcing the covenant would provide no substantial benefit to the plaintiffs, the original property owners who wanted it upheld. That's a pretty significant burden of proof on the individuals challenging a contract.
That does sound like a high bar to clear. Did the court ultimately find that the Johnsons had met these requirements?
No, they did not. While the court acknowledged that the area around Tracy Avenue had indeed seen an increase in black residents, they emphasized that the Johnsons had failed to provide sufficient evidence that the covenanted area itself had undergone radical changes.
So not enough change inside the restricted zone.
Correct. The court essentially drew a line, saying that shifts in the broader community, while perhaps noticeable, weren't enough on their own to invalidate the restrictions within the specifically agreed-upon area.
So even if the surrounding area was becoming more integrated, because Tracy Avenue itself remained largely white, the covenant was still considered valid and enforceable.
Precisely. The court drew a distinction. They differentiated this situation from other legal precedents where, for example, significant industrial development had overtaken a residential area with restrictions, fundamentally changing the nature of the property and making the original restrictions nonsensical.
Like a factory popping up next door.
Right. In those types of cases, courts might be more willing to acknowledge that conditions had changed so dramatically that the restrictions no longer served any reasonable purpose. However, in Porter v. Johnson, the court seemed to suggest that demographic shifts in the broader area were arguably something the original parties to the covenant might have even anticipated when they created the restrictions in the first place, the very reason for the covenant's existence.
That's a chilling thought, that the intended effect of the discrimination was used as a justification for upholding it. The court really saw this covenant as sacrosanct.
Absolutely. And the court went even further in solidifying its position. They characterized the restrictive agreement as property right, very similar to an easement.
An easement, like a right-of-way. Sort of, yes. Think of an easement like that right-of-way across someone's land. The court is saying this restrictive agreement creates a similar kind of embedded right for the other property owners, making it harder to undo than a simple contract dispute. They stated that these types of agreements create an interest in land for the benefit of the other property owners in the restricted district.
Ah.
And as a property right, the court felt it deserved significant legal protection unless there was a clear and compelling showing that it had been abandoned or that conditions within the restricted area itself had so radically changed as to completely defeat its original purpose.
So in the end, what was the final decision of the appellate court in Porter v. Johnson? What did they ultimately rule?
The appellate court reversed the trial court's initial ruling. They firmly held that the restrictive covenant was indeed legally enforceable. As a result, they ordered that the injunction be granted.
Meaning
Carl and Carrie Johnson were legally compelled to vacate the home they had purchased on Tracy Avenue. Wow. A devastating outcome for the Johnson family. And what was the driving force behind this final decision to enforce such a discriminatory agreement?
The majority opinion placed immense weight on what they repeatedly referred to as the sacredness of contracts. Their fundamental belief was that contractual agreements, freely entered into by consenting parties should be rigorously upheld by the courts, unless there was an exceptionally strong legal justification to set them aside.
So, contract above all else, basically.
In their view, yes. They felt the Johnsons had not provided sufficient evidence of radical changes within the specific boundaries of the restricted area to outweigh this core principle of contract law. Essentially, they argued that the Johnsons bought the property knowing about this restriction, so they were obligated to abide by it.
It really highlights a very formalistic approach to the law, prioritizing the written agreement perhaps at the expense of fundamental fairness and human dignity.
That's a very astute observation. However, it's worth noting that there was a concurring opinion from Judge Campbell on the appellate court that adds a layer of nuance to this decision.
Oh, interesting. So while he agreed with the final outcome of enforcing the covenant, he had a slightly different angle.
Exactly. Judge Campbell concurred with the judgment, meaning he agreed that in this specific instance, the restrictive covenant should be upheld. However, he expressed a more cautious perspective, specifically regarding the remedy of the injunction, the court order forcing the Johnsons to leave.
Okay.
He suggested that while the covenant itself might be valid in this case, courts should be very careful and narrowly tailor injunctions in such situations. He cautioned against overly broad remedies that could potentially cause undue hardship, even if the underlying agreement was deemed legally sound.
But that didn't actually change the outcome for the Johnsons.
No, it didn't. It's important to remember, though, that despite this nuanced perspective, Judge Campbell's concurrence did not change the ultimate harsh outcome for Carl and Carrie Johnson. They were still required to leave their home.
Looking back at Porter v. Johnson now, especially in light of later civil rights developments, what is its lasting significance? What does it tell us about the legal landscape before Shelley v. Kramer?
Its primary significance lies in its stark illustration of the legal system's acceptance and active enforcement of racial covenants in the years immediately preceding the Shelley v. Kramer Supreme Court decision in 1948.
Right before Shelley.
Exactly. Porter v. Johnson powerfully demonstrates how state courts at this time were willing to prioritize a contractual right to exclude based on race, even over the fundamental human rights and equitable concerns of black homebuyers. It really shines a light on the legal scaffolding that actively supported and maintained racial segregation in housing across the country.
It serves as a powerful and unsettling reminder that these discriminatory practices weren't just societal norms or individual prejudices. They were deeply embedded within and actively enforced by the legal system itself.
Precisely. And Porter v. Johnson stands as a clear and troubling example of a very strict approach to interpreting private contracts, even those with profoundly discriminatory aims. It reveals just how incredibly difficult it was for individuals like the Johnsons to successfully challenge these agreements in court based on the argument of changed conditions.
That burden of proof on internal changes.
Yes. The court's insistence that those changes had to be radical and occur within the specific restricted area created an almost insurmountable legal obstacle for those seeking to dismantle these discriminatory barriers.
So even as the world outside these covenanted neighborhoods might have been slowly shifting towards greater racial diversity, as long as that meticulously defined racially exclusive area remained predominantly white, the full force of the legal system could be deployed to keep it that way.
Exactly. This case really underscores the crucial and often uncomfortable role that the law played in actively contributing to and perpetuating racial segregation in housing. It wasn't simply a matter of private individuals acting on their biases. It was a system where those biases were codified and enforced by the state.
For law students today, especially those grappling with issues of civil rights and housing law, why is studying a seemingly outdated case like Porter v. Johnson still relevant and important?
Well, it's absolutely essential for understanding the long and often painful evolution of civil rights law in this country and the ongoing struggle for genuine equity. By examining cases like Porter, we gain critical insight into how legal reasoning can be used to both uphold and eventually challenge deeply discriminatory practices.
Understanding the past to understand the present.
Exactly. It provides crucial historical context for contemporary discussions surrounding housing equity, systemic inequalities that persist to this day, and the ever-evolving role of the law in either perpetuating or dismantling those inequalities. It also compels us to look beyond the seemingly neutral language of contracts and legal principles to consider their real-world impact on marginalized communities and broader principles of fairness and justice.
It definitely serves as a sobering and crucial reminder of the ways in which the legal system can be complicit in upholding deeply unjust social structures, and why ongoing vigilance and reform are so necessary.
Exactly. And understanding the legal landscape depicted in Porter v. Johnson makes the subsequent legal victories, most notably Shelley v. Kramer, all the more significant when we truly grasp the deeply entrenched legal framework they were up against.
So, to recap our deep dive into Porter v. Johnson, we've seen a 1921 racial covenant being actively enforced by the Missouri Court of Appeals in 1938. The court prioritized a very strict interpretation of contract law, placing an almost insurmountable burden on the black homebuyers, the Johnsons, to prove radical changes within the specific restricted area. This case starkly highlights the legal acceptance and enforcement of these profoundly discriminatory covenants in the years leading up to their eventual being deemed unenforceable by the Supreme Court and Shelley v. Kramer.
That's a comprehensive and accurate summary, and it really underscores the legal realities of the time and the immense uphill battle faced by those fighting against the deeply entrenched system of racial segregation in housing.
And on that crucial point, it really forces you to consider the enduring impact of historical legal decisions like Porter v. Johnson. Even though explicit racial covenants are no longer legally enforceable, what unseen and perhaps insidious legacies might such cases have left behind in shaping the landscape of our cities, the composition of our neighborhoods, and the persistent challenges we still face regarding housing equity? It's a sobering thought and definitely something to continue to reflect upon.
Indeed. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive. Until our next exploration, let's all continue to think critically about the law and its profound and lasting impact on our society.